The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce Beth Kephart. In her 15 books, novelist, memoirist, and essayist, Beth Kephart revels in the salvation of writing and reading, the choreography of stories, and the power of research. Her first memoir, A Slant of Sun, was a National Book Award finalist and rings of honesty, sincerity, and compassion, all hallmarks of the finest writing. A veteran teacher, she teaches memoir at the University of Pennsylvania. In her generous and insightful new book, she reflects on the art of writing and teaching memoir in transforming consciousness into great literature. You must, she tells us, let it filter through you. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Beth Kephart.
Thank you, Laura. You've disappeared. What a fantastic audience. Philadelphia, be still my heart. You know how much I love. Look at Bernadette. I see some friends out there. Thank you so much for being here. I am honored. The last time I was here was for this book flow about the Schuylkill River, and I was so surprised to find so many of you there that evening, too. So thank you for being here. I'm going to do some reading, you're going to do some writing, and I hope you're going to be brave and share with me some of the things that you produced tonight. But first, I do teach, as Laura, thank you for introducing me, and Joseph Fox Books, thanks for being here, and Free Library, thank you for having me. I do teach. It's what I love to do. I didn't really expect to write another book. I keep saying I've written my last book. But at the University of Pennsylvania, I meet such tremendous students, such souls. They're on the verge of everything, and I love them. And they've taught me a lot, and I've learned how to think about memoir simply by being near them and with them. I'm going to begin by just reading a preface to the book, and you'll see why I love these students the way I do. Maybe the audacity of it thrills you. Maybe it's always been like this. You out on the edge with your verity serums, your odd-sized heart, your wet eyes urging. Maybe this is what you are good for, after all, or good at. Though there, you've done it again, wanted proof, suggested the possibility. You teach memoir. You negotiate truth. Goodness doesn't matter here. Bearing witness does. Memoir is a strut and a confession, a whisper in the ear, a scream. Memoir performs, then seeds. It is the work of thieves. It is a seduction and a sleight of hand, and the world won't rise above it, or you won't. You and that Victorian manse at the edge of the Ivy League campus, where you arrive early and sit in the attitude of prayer. You who knew something, not just of the toil, but also of the psychic cost, the pummeling doubt, the lacerating regrets that live in the aftermath of public confession. You have written memoir in search of the lessons children teach, and in confusion over the entanglements of friendships. You've written in despair regarding the sensational impossibility of knowing another, in defense of the imperiled imagination, and in the throes of a loathsome sink toward middle age. You have written quiet and expected quiet, and yet a terrible noise has hurried in, a churlish self-recrimination that cluttered the early hours when clear-minded, non-memorists slept. You have learned from all that you have decided. Memoir is and will still be, but cautions must be taken. Teaching memoir is teaching verge. It's teaching questions. Who are you? Where have you been? Where are you going? What do you believe in? What will you fight for? What is the sound of your voice? It's teaching now against then, and leave that out to put this in. And yes, maybe that happened, but what does it mean? An affront? You hope not. A calling? Probably. You enter a classroom of students you have never seen before. And over the course of a semester, you travel, their forgotten paraphernalia in the well of their backpacks, those tattoos on their wrists, those bio notes linked onto the palm of one hand. They will remember their mother's London broil, but not the recipe. They will proffer a profusion of umbrellas and a poor-fitting snowsuit, a pair of polka-dotted boots, red roses at a Pakistani grave, a white billiard ball, a pink and orange sari, a box with a secret bottom. Ciao, bello, Giletto. Someone will make a rat-a-tat out of a remembered list. Someone will walk you through the corridors of the sick or through the staged room of a movie set or beside the big bike that will take them far. Someone will say, teach me how to write like this. And someone will ask what good writing is, and you will read out loud from the memoirs you have loved, debunk systematically, and proselytize effusively, perform Patti Smith and Terence Dupré, Jeffrey Wolfe and Mark Richard, Marie Arana and Mary Carr, Michael Ondaatje, C.K. Williams, Natalie Kutz. You will play recordings of Sylvia Plath reciting Lady Lazarus and Etheridge Knight, intoning the idea of ancestry, and you will say in a room made dark by entrusted velvet and mahogany stain, you tell me good, you tell me why, know your opinions, defend them. These aspiring makers of memoir are who you believe and what you believe in. The smiley face he wears on Frat Rush Tuesday, the cheerful interval between her two front teeth, the planks he carries in his dark blue backpack, the accoutrements of powerlifting. Enamored of the color red and hip-hop, declaring you their galentine, impersonating Whitman, missing their mothers, missing their dead, they are simply and complexly human, and they may not trust themselves with truth, but they have to trust one another. You insist that they earn the trust of one another. And so you will send them out into the world with cameras. And so you will sit them down with songs. And so you will ask them to retrieve what they lost, and after that to leave aside the merely incidental. You will set a box of cookies on the table, some chocolate-covered berries, some salt-encrusted chips, and then at last get out of the way. For every memoir must in the end and on its own emerge and bleed and scab. Audacity was the wrong word. You see that now. The word, in fact, is privilege. Teaching after all these years is the marrow in your bones. Truth is your obsession. So what is memoir? It is so often misinterpreted. It's interesting. On my blog recently, I asked people to put their most favorite memoir there. And on the list of contributions to that, half of them were not actually memoir. There were novels that are memoiristic, that come from truth. There are autobiographies, which are not memoir. There were collections of essays. There were diaries. But memoir is something very specific. Memoir is a form that is ridiculed and has lost face. And I am here with this bright orange neon book to try to win it back its place, its proper place. So memoir is not, I start with that in the book because it's so confusing to so many. Here are some of the things that memoir is not. A chronological, thematically tone-deaf recitation of everything remembered. That's autobiography, which should be left in this 21st century to politicians and celebrities. Oh, be honest, just leave it. A typeset version of a diary scrawl, unfiltered, unshaped. There are remarkable diaries. A Woman in Berlin, for example, is artful, heartbreaking, essential. New York Diaries is a thrill. But the method of a diarist is to record events and thoughts as they are happening. A memoirist looks back. It's not exhibitionism for exhibitionism's sake. If nothing's been learned from a life, is it worth sharing? Or if nothing's been learned yet, shouldn't the story wait? It's not an accusation, a retaliation, a big take that in type. Fights are waged in bedrooms and courthouses. A memoir is not a fight. It's not a lecture, a lesson, a stew of information and facts. Memoirs illuminate and reveal as opposed to justify and record. They connote and suggest, but they never insist. It's not a self-administered therapy session. We know these books, right? Memoirists speak to others and not just to themselves. It's not an exercise in self-glorification, an ability or refusal to accept one's own culpability, a false allegiance to the idea that a life, any life, can be perfectly lived or faultlessly explained. It's not an unwillingness to recognize, either explicitly or implicitly, that memory is neither machine nor uncontestable. Memory, our own and others, is tricky, fallible business. And finally, it is not a trumped-up, fantastical idea of what an interesting life might have been if only. It's not a web of lies, a smudge, a mockery of reality. There is a separate, even equal category for such things, and it goes by the name of fiction. So, when we are here to write and work together a little bit, so I find with writing that it helps, especially with memoir, not to hit something right on the head, not to go right at it directly. And so I like to think of myself sort of twisting the camera around always to find that oblique angle. So there's something that I love to do and something I've done a couple of times now, that where we write the autobiography of something we've brought with us. I'm going to give you two examples. I didn't bring the Schuylkill River with me, but I did bring the book I wrote. And in this case, I'm just going to read you a few paragraphs from two things to get you warmed up. This is the Schuylkill River speaking. She thinks she's perfect when this book begins. She is sure she's perfect. And she, like her author, her person that wrote the book, is obsessed with language. This is how she sounds when we first meet her. From within the fissure I rise, old as anything. The gravel beneath me slides, blue back herring and eel, alewife and shad, muscle into my wide blue heart and through. The smudged face of a wolf pools on my surface, and for that one instant I go blind. Hemlock to either side, nut trees, laurel copses, the stony backs of snapping turtles on the shore, muskrat, shrew, and from the unlantered forest, the bark of a fox, the skith, skith, skith of snakes over leaves, the prowl of a bobcat. And when it rains, the rain is its own kind of song, not just a drumming, but a lyric. Were there language, I'd be my own lone letter. So she sounds like that. I was in Miami with my beautiful husband, who I'm so happy is here tonight, in January. And we met 24 incredible young writers. And I asked them to write the autobiography of their hair. And Bill took their very, very beautiful photographs. And then I had to play the game, too. So I am going to share with you how my hair, you know, it demonizes me, this hair. It just never, ever behaves. And so this is how my hair sounds when it speaks. Also obsessed with language. Language like fumes. Language particulate and strange. The caper of a thought cleaved. Here are some words. Efflorescence, interjacent, rune. Here is the vast task of my existence. To listen. I am electrostatic fizz, I am frump, I am inconvenient, I am fallen, twisted, clawed, resisted, shamed. There are 100,000 of me, but in the spaces in between, I breathe what I've learned, we. And then she goes on, this hair. What I want you to do is to take something that you've brought with you, in your pockets, in your purse, something that you've brought with you, and you have 5 minutes to write its autobiography. Okay? And I'm hoping that at least two or three of you will share, because it's actually very fun to do this. And what you're doing, what are you doing? You're stretching your language. You're seeing what happens when you're not so self-consciously writing about yourself, but you're writing about something that is close to yourself. 5 minutes, and I think I can see. Can you see the time? I can't see, actually. Paper and pen. I was hoping people would... There's the back of the book. I don't know. Tell me, first of all, some of the interesting things you found in your pockets or on your person. And you have to participate because that's what this is all about. Julie, what did you bring with you that you wrote about? Your hand splint.
Yes.
Would you be willing
My
to...
My hand splint.
Would you be willing to share what you wrote?
Yes.
Thank you.
But for you,
and I'll
Beth.
Pay you later.
For you, Beth. Okay. I am restriction, sticky Velcro tabs and rigid aluminum that allows. I allow writing, drawing, carrying the burden of work. And even in sleep, I hold hands. Either one, I don't care. Wait, yes, I do. No, I don't. I simply hold, squeezing away stiffness and aches like a cradle. No rocking permitted. Stay still. The nerve of some people.
So that's pretty wonderful, pretty darn wonderful. And I'm going to just collect a few more and then talk about this, what you learn from this. Is there anybody else who's willing to share anything out there? Back there, thank you for being brave. And wait for the mic, I've been told to say, and I hope I remember to say it.
I'm pea green. So green. Shit green. How did that happen? She pulled me out of the box where they keep me in the closet. Smothered by winter coats. She took me because she said it looks like rain. Before the box in the closet, I lived at the Rite Aid. Hung on a display, picked over. Me, picked over. I heard the mutter, pea green, shit green, and then move on.
You do not need me here. You do not need me here. I wonder how that green would feels about this orange. I don't know what that's going to look like together. No, I don't think so. You've got that voice. Are there any other people who would be willing to share what they've discovered? Yes, right here.
Take me at once out of your pocket, at once, and keep your fingers away from the keyboard, for it is a lie to your truth. It lies about your connection, your hand, your fingers, and your heart. But your pen, that's me, chosen for its needle nib, for its scratch on the paper, for its light muscled turns of the wrist and arm, connected always to the heart. Not distant and mysterious like a dark screen sprung to life with the tap of a key, and always at arm's length or worst. Not that, but instead the scuttle of mice feet on paper, the testimony of a heart's truth given by a shaky hand and crabbed fingers pressing on.
5 minutes. I mean, seriously, 5 minutes. Amazing. Amazing. One more. Anybody else? Go ahead.
Rather than something in my purse, or I wrote of my purse.
All right.
I was created by my owner to be an extension of her, to shout for her, sort of, not a whisper, an invitation, a declaration, a command, but no pressure. I'm softened by the images of the very kissable beings on the reverse side. Two piglets in the grass, heads down, snouts rooting in the dirt. But I am the main attraction. Side A, facing the world. Bright white letters on solid black to be sure you notice me. The message. I'm the most important part of the bag. Love animals, eat vegetables.
I love these pieces that emerge, and without belaboring it, because we're going to do a number of things, when you go home, if you want to, if you've written, if you want to continue this, now write about that object using your own voice, talking to it or with it in some way, and measure the distance between the language that you see. I'm going to wager that your first effort is more free, more inspired maybe, more full of unexpected imagery. And I'm going to suggest that possibly for those who are writing about themselves, there's that choke moment of, I have to get it right, and the language gets constrained. What we want to do with memoir is not just tell a story, not just search for meaning, we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but to create art. Don't ever lose sight of the possibilities of language. And when you're stuck, choose a persona that is not yourself, but something close to yourself so that you can step sideways back towards yourself. I'm going to talk about weather. I have a chapter in the book called Weather, the Weather. I'm going to read part of it, not all of it. But it is 3 pages of reading. So I'm going to just choose some paragraphs here. I know what the weather was when my mother died. I had spent the final difficult months at her side, had sung her songs, had placed and replaced the flowers and photographs, the potted lemon tree, the Bible, in what would become her last room. I had heard, will never forget hearing, what she meant for me to hear. I had said goodbye because I knew it was her time, because I had somehow understood that she wished her dying to be a private thing. And so I was out, walking in the dark beneath a few bright stars, when I felt the nudge of a breeze on one shoulder, a knock, and then a whoosh. Mom, I said, for it was her, I knew, her final earthly touch. I remember weather, do you? I am convinced by it. So on mornings when I wake to the whisper rush of snow, when I feel the roof heavying down, the silence deeper than the previous night, my sentences grow long, embedded, rounded. But then on days that are blue sky and angling for warmth, my sentences take on the connotations of jive. They're all quick step and electric slide. There's no escaping this, or there shouldn't be. Weather and how we both live and write it must enter, should enter, into the memories we make and resurrect. Look outside, go outside, write this right now. The quality of breeze, the evidence of dew, the pile of clouds on the horizon, find the words. It doesn't matter how tired you are. It doesn't matter if you think there's nothing new here, if weather has been done before, if weather isn't, to you at least, the story. An alive sky is a whole soul. You must let it filter through you. Watermelon, lilac, gunmetal blue, upticking fog, rain as the sound, sun as a caution sign, a moon that has gone fishing, a cranberry-colored landscape, cold for August, thunder like a jet just off the tarmac, hail the size of rock salt, the straight white nails of rain driving through, or just the gray, pale pink before a storm, or again, fog curl with a mind of its own. Write the weather of this instance. Find the words. Put yourself in a weather zone, and then let your mind drift back. Write the weather of your wedding day now, or the weather of your first school day, or the weather of a funeral day, or the weather of a carefree day. What is on your page? Is it rhapsodic? Is it stark? Is it original? Is it true? Where do weather memories and weather words take you? And one more paragraph. Too many people forget when writing memoir the power of context, the evocative tug of the broader tapestry. They'll focus on lines of actions, on he said, she said, they did. They'll show you the crimes or craft of a five-page monologue or slam you with the simmering gossip, I was young, I lost my mind. And in all this rendering of the facts, as best as any facts can be recalled and subsequently rendered, the wider world gets lost. The extenuating circumstances, the reality that things are always bigger than you or me. And I'm going to skip to include my really great friend, Allison Hagee, one of the best writers and a very important person to me. She writes to me almost every day, and every day she lives in Laramie, Wyoming. When she writes about weather. So here's an example of Allison writing to me casually. The hint of autumn was subtle. The way the clouds built in the morning, not as mountains of clouds, but as layers of cumulus and cirrus. The early cry of the fledgling red-tailed hawks that have nested in the neighborhood and are now just out on their own, so wary yet so dangerous, they have quieted the crows. The way the dust on the breeze smelled cool instead of hot. It's usually 50 in the morning now instead of 55. The days are still glorious and bright, but you can see how the robins are hustling to plump up for departure. Story there, right? The tantalizing breath of memoir. It's Allison yielding the wide, ungovernable world of her weather, and at the same time, it's her way of seeing, her patterns of perception. Tell me how you see your weather, and you will tell me something of yourself. I want to know not just what you see, but how you see in every line that you call memoir. So you have 2 minutes to write a single sentence about a weather moment that mattered. Where did your minds go? Any thoughts from my two friends in the front row?
After the car slid sideways up the curb and onto the sidewalk, everything stopped. The motor, the horn, the brakes, everything, except the rain through the broken window.
gorgeous. We have two brothers who are tremendous poets who I've had the pleasure of seeing at various events through the years. Other weather moments from anyone out there?
May 25th, cool, but electricity is in the air. It's pouring rain as we barrel down the shiny asphalt of 95 South at 9:30 at night on the way to Elkton, Maryland. It had rained all day. What a day to elope.
Perfect. Perfect. Anybody else with a moment? Ah, there's so many. I'm going to start here and say wait for the mic like a good citizen.
I-95 must be in a lot of people's thoughts. That was mine as well. It was I-95, January 1990, and I was crossing a lake in southern Georgia when the setting sun painted the sky with every color in the rainbow. Can't read this now. Silhouetted against the black trees, I stopped and searched for a camera, but decided that the experience was worth more than the photograph.
Oh, I've had those moments. Thank you for that. So your words now become the photograph. There's more burden on those words to be right. So beautiful. I saw other hands out that way.
We are sliding back down the hill on this road in the Mojave. Your contractions 10 minutes apart. With every shift, every attempt to shift, the U-Haul we were pulling shoves us back on this heat-shimmering road.
There's a lot of weather and travel, this conjunction of movement that is interesting and is psychologically ingrained. There was someone in a green t-shirt with her hand up right there in the middle.
When we left the Farm Journal building, after they'd plunged the chemo port into his chest so that the harsh chemicals could go straight to his heart, he looked up at the blue, blue sky and said, "It's September 11th weather."
Beautiful. Anybody else that want one more that might want to? So over here.
November 23rd, 1998. Sunset on my mother's 90th birthday, high in the Smoky Mountains, the colors of the sky not only in the west, but encircling the entire 360 degrees of the horizon. Flames, heaven, and flowing, changing imperceptibly from gold to orange, red to purple, from wide stripes to narrow streaks. The slow movements, the shouts of celebration and wonder that our family together witnessed.
Beautiful. I'm always so amazed by what happens when given just a few minutes in a crowded room to write what happens. And in handling the truth and in the way I go about my own work, it's incremental, right? You build a book incrementally. You build it by remembering weather and landscape and cooking and favorite songs, and you go back to your photographs and your scrapbooks. It's not a straight line narrative. If it is, again, you're wading into the difficult and dangerous territory of "it's all about me" autobiography. It's not what you want to do as a memoirist. In fact, what you want to do is search for meaning. So I told you a little bit ago about what memoir is not. I have much more in the book about what memoir is. And I'm just going to read. And in this book, there are about 100 different memoirs, little excerpts of them or references to them that matter to me, that have taught me, and that do qualify as memoir. These are the books, and there are many others, and on my blog I continue to write about memoir and process. And in fact, in the last 3 weeks, I had to write 12 new essays about memoir, of stuff that's not in the book at all. So I was genuinely stretched by the exercise, but I emerged on the other side. This is what memoir is. If you want to write memoir, you need to set caterwauling narcissism to the side. You need to soften your stance.
You need to work through the explosives, anger, aggrandizement, injustice, misfortune, despair, fumes, toward mercy. Real memoirists, literary memoirists, don't justify behaviors, decisions, moods. They don't ladder themselves up high, 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 so as to look down upon the rest of us. Real memoirists open themselves to self-discovery, and in the process, make themselves vulnerable, not just to the world, but also to themselves. They yearn, and they are yearned with. They declare a want to know. They seek out loud, they quiet, they lessen the distance, they lean toward. Listen to Michael Ondaatje, whose work I love, as he sets out to rediscover and make sense of his Sri Lankan childhood. These words from the opening pages of Running in the Family. You have to get this book. I had already planned the journey back, he writes. During quiet afternoons, I spread maps onto the floor and searched out possible routes to Ceylon. But it was only in the midst of this party, among my closest friends, that I realized I would be traveling back to the family I had grown from, those relations from my parents' generation who stood in my memory like frozen opera. Love that. I wanted to touch them into words. Love that. A perverse and solitary desire. In Jane Austen's Persuasion, I had come across the lines, quote, she had been forced into prudence in her youth. She learned romance as she grew older, the natural sequence of an unnatural beginning, end quote. In my mid-30s, I realized I had slipped past a childhood I had ignored and not understood. He is going back to understand, not to report. Listen to Diane Keaton. You can be a celebrity in white memoir. She did. She wrote, then again, and she uses collage, letters, written, journals, plums, secrets exposed, to parse a question and explore, beautifully, calmly, as a human being and not as a star, a thoughtfully articulated theme. It's all here in a single sentence. It's not easy gloss. It's the crinkly stuff of living and losing, and it sets her book in motion. Here we go. Comparing two women with big dreams who shared many of the same conflicts and also happened to be mother and daughter is partially a story of what's lost in success contrasted with what's gained in accepting an ordinary life. This is her framing. You have to build framing. Maybe memoir for some is the queen of the nasties, the medical horror story, the impossible loss story, the abuse story, the deprivation story, the I've been cheated story, the headline making you're kidding me story. But plot, which is to say the stuff of life, is empty if it doesn't signify. And the unexamined tragedy, thank you, Socrates, isn't worth the trees it will be inked on or the screen that fingers will smudge. Some of the best memoirs are built not from sensate titillations, but from the contemplation of universal questions within a framed perspective. And I'll give you one more. It's Annie Dillard. How could we not talk about Annie Dillard? She's not a victim in her growing up classic and American childhood. She's a woman looking back on what it meant to grow awake to the world, not just in the world. Here are her words. I woke in bits, like all children, piecemeal over the years. I discovered myself in the world and forgot them and discovered them again. I woke at intervals until by that September when father went down the river, the intervals of waking tipped the scales and I was more often awake than not. I noticed this process of waking and predicted with terrifying logic that one of these years not far away, I would be awake continuously and never slip back and never be free of myself again. Isn't that gorgeous? I have to do one more. C.K. Williams, and then we have 15 more minutes, so we have time. While loss frames this great poet, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet's single memoir, Misgivings, it's not the tragedy he's chasing, it's understanding. I've met him, I interviewed him and wrote about him, but then he also came to Penn, and he's very tall, he's very elegant, and I wish he were here to read these words himself, but here I'm doing it for him. I know he would intone, my father dead. I come into the room where he lies and I say aloud, immediately concerned that he might still be able to hear me, what a war we had. To my father's body, I say it, still propped up on its pillows before the men from the funeral home arrive to put him into their horrid zippered green bag to take him away before his night table is cleared of the empty bottles of pills he wolfed down when he'd finally been allowed to end the indignity of his suffering and had found the means to do so. before my mother comes in to lie down beside him. When my mother dies, I'll say to her, as unexpectedly, knowing as little what I'm going to do, I love you. But to my father again now, my voice is through, as though of its own accord, blurts, what a war! And I wonder again why I'd say that. It's been years since my father and I raged at each other the way we once did, violently, rancorously, seeming to loathe, despise, detest one another. Years since we'd learned, perhaps from each other, perhaps each in our struggles with ourselves, that conflict didn't have to be as it had been for so long, the routine state of affairs between us. Framing devices, right? They aren't saying, I am telling you the story of my life. They are saying, I am searching toward an understanding of one aspect of my life. I have preposterously written 5 memoirs. I am a very boring human being and an extremely bad potter, as some of the people here know. But I have been searching for answers to questions. What does friendship look like? How do the people who enter our lives change who we become? How do we deal with middle age? What happens when we let the imagination free in a society that is all about competition with our children? I wanted to know the answers to these questions, and I cannot tell you that I started out. If I had started out, I'll put it this way, knowing the answer to those questions, those books would have been linguistically dead. There is no reason to write them because the answers are already known. The raw truth, the beauty of memoir, is in the search. But you can't do the search unless you have that voice you're working on, and you can't do it unless you know what you're framing. And so I challenge each of you for just a minute to write down what you think your memoir would be about, and to look at that and see, is that a narrative plot I've just described, or is that a search for understanding? Just put it down for a minute, and then I'll close with one small additional reading. So just 10 more seconds to put it down. And when you look at that, how many of you are seeing framing, honestly, and how many of you are seeing a this is what happened to me device? So in 5 seconds, I will ask you for a show of hands. And so, the 5 seconds are up. How many see plot? Just raise your hand in what you've got there. Do all of you see framing? The rest of you all see framing? Okay. Anybody willing to share what the nature of that framing is? Just maybe 2 frames.
Did I do good or just ego?
Okay. You can pursue that. You can definitely pursue that. You had something here, yes, down here.
I was going to ask you to explain what you meant by frame again, but what I wrote was why painting has captivated me for so much of my life.
Okay.
Is that a frame?
That is a question that you will be pursuing that will lead you to a frame. So yes, that's a very good beginning. The framing being that there's sort of intellectual, emotional poles that are going to provide the borders and the boundaries for what you write. That question is going to take you into the heart of it. You're going to work on that and toss around and throw a lot of stuff out. And then about halfway through or two-thirds of the way through a first draft, you might say to yourself, I know what the framing is here. And that is going to tell you what to put in and, most importantly, what to leave out. Memoir, the artistry of memoir, is so tied to leaving so much good stuff but irrelevant stuff out. The frame, the questions help you figure out what that is. I'm going to close these last 5 minutes by reading 4 paragraphs towards the end of the book. Seek beauty. I believe in beauty. Some people call me sentimental, but I believe in it. I was the kid with the willow tree bark at her back and the blank page book on her lap, writing sonnets to Zeus and his cohorts. I was cloud-swept and purple-saturated, tipped toward melody and song. I skated on ponds, and speed was a poem. I looked for meaning in the places where the hues of separate watercolors met and blurred. I sat on the bridge, watching the poor creek go by, desperate for something to say. Poetry was my ideal, a vast seduction. the way an image could be made to turn in on itself, the way sound itself was meaning, the economics of signifiers, the metering of intent, complexity, grace, mystery, intrigue, the fantastic smithereening and reconstituting of vocabulary itself, the inherent possibility that something original could be said. It was breathtaking. I wanted poetry for myself, just as I want memoir. Just as all that lives in a poem is possible, I believe this in memoir. The endearing and the enduring, the subversive and the supposed, the ephemeral and the everlasting, the yelp and the yowl, the you within the me. This is what I love about memoir. This, like my son's face, like the ocean at dawn, like yellow wings in a blooming tree, like the cadence of a jungle hill, like a fleet of winter stars, is beauty to me. Teach me how to write like this. It was my student Gabe who said it. He'd come to class early carrying words a friend had written, and he'd asked me how sentences like those got made. Gabe was studying engineering. He knew process and mechanics, but here he was in my still dark classroom asking me to teach him beauty. And so we moved through the opening lines of his friend's work, trying to discern where beauty lived. Where was momentum and where was pause? Where were the oblique corners, the unexpected encounters, the phrases where the writing suggested mastery not just over topic, but over harmony too? Gabe had to know where the beauty lay for him before he could begin making beauty for himself, and it is no different for you or for me. And just so that you know, Gabe, my engineer, wrote one hell of a beautiful, meaningful memoir. He found beauty. It is 8:30. I promised to close at 8:30, so I will. Thank you so, so much for being here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.